Yemidi. Écoutez, à midi.
Quelle heure est-il ?
Il est midi.
C'est l'heure de déjeuner.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y a à manger ?
Des saucisses.
Écoutez et répétez. À midi. À midi.
Quelle heure est-il ? Quelle heure ? Quelle heure est-il ? Est-il ? Quelle heure est-il ?
Il est midi. 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 Il est midi. Il est midi.
C'est l'heure de déjeuner. C'est l'heure. C'est l'heure de déjeuner. De déjeuner. C'est l'heure de déjeuner.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm so happy today to have in the studio with me Jennifer Sperry Steinnorth. Jen, welcome. Welcome to Living Writers.
Thanks so much for having me, T. Thanks for having my whole class.
Yeah, this is English 125 that you brought along with you today, along with your new book, Boys Behind Glass, that is out. You're going to be reading in Chicago this weekend. Mm-hmm. So the books are hot off the press from TRP, the University Press of SHSU. Mm-hmm. And then you'll be coming to Literati in March.
Yes.
And you'll be in like a little bit closer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then Traverse City. You'll be doing the Michigan gigs. Yeah. But today you're here at WCBN. And I'm so glad you are. You came through the winter to get here and you brought your students in English 125.
I did. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the name of the class, Jen?
Oh, gosh.
Oh, wait. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Well. technology. Let's see. Writing as a technology of thought, I think is the title.
Whoa, that's great.
And shouldn't be a question at the end of that.
Thoughts?
Thought?
I don't know. Are we thinking?
Yes.
Are we? Yeah, we are. We are. Mm-hmm. And we're going to do some talking, hear some of your poems, hear about this amazing collaboration that you had with the painter Jenny Walton to create this book, Boys Behind Glass. Yeah. Thanks so much for being here.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
I'll say a quick word because we are on the verge of the fundraiser, the Fun and Fund fundraiser for WCBN. It's coming up. It starts February 13th, which is, I hope everyone, if you don't know it, you're going to know it now, World Radio Day, which is an excellent day to kick off fundraiser, February 13th. Then February 14th from 12 a.m. to 7 a.m., we have our epic Night of Noise, our annual cacophonous celebration of noise in all forms. So that's going to be... That's just something.
Sounds fabulous.
One of those traditions that CBN has. And then February 20th at Blind Pig, the fundraiser concert. So please show up for that. That would be brilliant to be part of fundraiser and with the music, bands with UM students in them. And then February 26th, we're having Searching for Sugar Man, a screening at the State Theater. And that gives me a chance to say support for programming comes from the nonprofit Michigan and State Theaters, Ann Arbor's only independent movie theaters, presenting Michigan-made films, the Cinetopia Film Festival, and a year-round lineup of film, live stage shows, and concerts you won't find anywhere else, located in downtown Ann Arbor. So on the 26th of February, you can join WCBN for a free film screening of Searching for Sugar Man, connecting back to like music from Detroit
awesome.
Roots. Yeah. Okay. Well, Jen, I'm so happy you're here. And Boys Behind the Glass is the occasion for our coming here to talk.
Yeah.
It's hot off the press. How long was it in the making? Because this is a collaborative project.
It is.
And it seems like you were at the Vermont Art Studio Center.
Yes.
And yeah.
So I was I was at Vermont Studio Center in January of 2017. There was a big inauguration that happened that it was the first inauguration of our current president. And I met the artist Jenny Walton, who had just completed the series that a selection from which appears in the book. The series is called Match Enemy, and it is she created over 200 watercolor portraits of the public-facing profile pics of men she had been matched with on OkCupid, specifically men who didn't show recognizable faces. So it's sort of a kaleidoscopic catalog of a survey of sorts of anonymity, men courting via, you know, representing themselves via anonymity. And so I was fascinated by this and asked if I could respond to it. And that's sort of when it started.
And so you met Jenny Walton there.
Yes.
And you were both at Vermont's Studio Center.
Yeah, we were both there doing
month long fellowships.
Yeah. Yeah, we were both there doing month-long residencies.
When you went, Jen, did you have an idea of a project you were going to work on, or were you going to sort of be open and find something or be open to collaborating?
Yeah, I was definitely open to collaborating, but I didn't really start it then. I was working on Her Read, my second book. And so I was working on that a lot, and I actually my first book hadn't come out yet, and I actually did a complete overhaul of my first book too. So that happened. I overhauled the first book. I was really working on the second book, and then the seed for this was planted.
Began in 2017.
This third book, yeah,
and then Jenny Walton, the painter, she lives in D.C.
She does. Yeah.
So what's it like to do a long distance collaboration? Were you able to go to some of the exhibits, or did anything inform you in that way, or was it? Well, how did you choose the works that you?
She just gave me full license. Like we didn't really, we did have some conversations via Zoom. We had several conversations, but the work. Basically, I am responding to her work, and she was like, I like your work, and I trust you, and so, really, the book is. Sort of all I kind of designed the book and wrote in response to. So there's a conversation that's happening, but most of her part of the conversation happened before the work was created, and then we talked a little bit about her process.
And then it feels like the conversation or the talking continues within the pages.
Exactly.
Boys.
Yeah.
Behind glass.
Absolutely.
So what was it about the images that you saw in Vermont that made you feel connected to this? Because the Match Enemy, OkCupid, her scenario, yeah. I think she's a single person,
yes.
In sort of like the, you know, the hetero world, sort of looking
absolutely.
For partnering. Whereas your situation is you've been married for half your life,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. I mean, as I was finishing this, as I finished the last major aspect of the book, I was in my 50th year and 25 years married. So, which felt like an important subject position to make visible. But yes, you're right. And in fact, it felt important to make my positionality visible because I was this sort of voyeur that wasn't, you know, a woman on OkCupid. My marriage predates online dating, and so I've never done that. But I was fascinated by the representations of men representing themselves, and so often it's female. Women are subject to the male gaze, and so these are men presenting themselves for the female gaze. But there is also a way in which, especially in these manifestations of anonymity, there's a resistance to subjecting themselves. In fact, like there's an image where there's a man giving the finger to the, you know, like that's so interesting. It's also like, wow, you're courting a woman by giving her, you know, you're showing. That particular image shows a naked torso. Perhaps he's entirely naked. The picture's cut off by, you know, we're not seeing anything. untoward. But we're seeing a naked torso and then the man giving the finger. And it's like there's this sort of hostility to the prospect of presenting oneself as sort of meat, which is so understandable. Women definitely understand this. But it's sort of a role reversal.
Yes. And so was it interesting to you to think of like, then since you, like you said, you weren't part of the,
right,
the original, like the scenario.
Sure.
Was it interesting to have that other distance? Because in the book, I mean, we've got to talk about, sure, how we like the design of the book, the creation of it. But in maybe one of the first like section of the book, where there's a painting usually on one page, and then on the facing page, there'll be a poem.
Yeah, a sonnet.
Could we talk about that?
Sure.
To start.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, there's sort of a mirror. I mean, you have the one side is this watercolor portrait that is it's a close, she's not taking license here. I mean, she is representing whatever it was, the profile pic via watercolor. And I am writing from the perspective of a omniscient narrator that is looking into the mind of a woman who is looking at the men as somebody that's on the dating site. So there's a sort of a double fictional character. There's the narrator, and then there's the fictional woman that is not the artist. It is totally a woman out of my mind.
Is that how the project started for you? Or did you make that decision, or did you write it in different ways when you were mirroring these watercolors?
No, that's how it came. And well, I thought I was going to be writing these little prose poems that were in the shape of the block.
Yes, yeah, that, okay.
But then what happened?
They became sonnets.
But they started coming out as sonnets, and I was like, duh, a sonnet is the, you know, the form of courtly love. And so, you know, and it seems so hilarious that like they came out as sonnets. Like they just, like you just, ugh, I'm just writing and out pops a sonnet. That's not how it works. But,
right.
You know, it's like, it's got a turn around that time. It's about that size. I think it was something about the reflecting mode, but also there's a tradition of portraiture in sonnets. Like sonnet is a traditional, that's part of the lineage of sonnets. So that also felt appropriate and was fun to play with. And it was fun to like have the sonnet form to flex with the sonnet, because some of the sonnets are like exploded and some of them are taking other sorts of shapes.
And yeah, when you say exploded, that mm-hmm. means it looks very different than what you might expect from like a Shakespearean sonnet on the page.
Right.
Can you describe that and why it was necessary to explode it on the page?
Yeah. Well, some of the images appear over and over again across the 200 pages, the 200 portraits. So like there are themes that were present in Jenny's work. One of them is like, there's a lot of cowboys. There are a lot of representations of Superman. There were a lot of naked torsos. So those are things that are, I was like, okay, I want to speak to this. So one of them is there are three images of cowboys that have like sort of a cowboy theme. And then I ended up with a sonnet that is divided into, it reads across, it's 14 lines, but it's divided up into quadrants. So you can read, it's like I'm having a hard time thinking about how to describe this. Quadrants, so you can read the four boxes one at a time, or you can read vertically down one column and then the next, or you can read horizontally across. So there's just a lot of different options for how you read them.
One of the ways, maybe. But speaking of options, this whole book is full of options. It's almost like, I think in the very beginning, you acknowledge that as like a choose your own adventure.
Yeah.
Sort of way through when you're saying how you might even read this book.
Yeah.
And it's full of play, and it's full of like, you can never take a joke, like, and when I say joke, even a serious thought too far. It's like watching the mind of how your mind is working with this.
Yeah.
Through endnotes, asterisks.
Yeah.
And to hear you describe, you know what, let's take a short break and then let's come back and we'll hear that poem.
Okay.
Does that sound good, everyone? Okay. Yeah. All right. So today on Living Writers, Jen Steinnorth is here. Her book, Boys Behind Glass. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got the Reverend Andrew behind the glass, and we've got Jen's class here as the studio audience. We'll be back. In. I'm so glad you did. Today on the program, Jennifer Sperry Steinnorth is here. Her book, Boys Behind Glass, on the table with us. You know what? Before I forget, because I'm very happy to have Jen here in the studio, I'm just casually chatting with Jen. I'm forgetting that I should read your bio.
Okay.
So here we go. Jennifer Sperry Steinnorth's books include Awake with Nine Shades, a finalist for the Eric Hoffer Prize, and Her Read, a graphic poem, recipient of the Forward Review's Bronze Prize for Poetry and the Fred Whitehead Award from the Texas Institute of Letters. A poet, educator, interdisciplinary artist, and scholar, she has received grants from Yale, Vermont Studio Center, the University of Michigan, Sewanee Writers Conference, Community of Writers, and the MFA for Writers at Warren Wilson College. She lectures at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, Go Blue, and is writing a biography of American poet C.D. Wright, who I hope we get to talk about, because C.D. was on the show some years ago.
Amazing.
So sitting in the seat you are sitting in now, Jen.
Be still my heart.
So poets unite across time and years and place. So before the break, we were talking about the cowboy exploded sonnet.
Yeah, yeah.
In Boys Behind Glass. But during the break, everybody, we decided like that might not be the first point of entry, because it isn't. It's not the lead poem in the book. And when you're structuring the experience for your readers, even though you generously said start wherever you will,
yes, indeed,
that poem might not be the first one. So what would you like to read, Jen?
I'll read a different exploded sonnet.
Okay.
And this one is it is opposite. It's again, we're sort of getting a torso. It's a shot of the watercolor shows a man who is in a cocktail almost like a burlesque with garter belt stockings, and the skirt is sort of kicked up, and we're seeing him from the shoulder down to the like mid thigh, and the skirt is like flying up, and he's kind of holding it down with his hand. And so
again, headless.
Yeah. Again, headless. Yeah. There's lots of, I can read a little bit later about maybe the headless thing, but for right now, this sonnet is sort of, deconstructed, where it's still a 14 line, the pacing of it still works. It could be made into a properly looking sonnet, but it felt appropriate to the content, to explode it. And maybe that will become clear as I read it. The title is Okay, Bloom. She loves the mess a flower makes. Dogwoods, snowy dandruff, salting manicured lawns, roses rouging driveways, and trees, mulberries sticky ebony stains or sugar maples four-season debris. How even deep winter boughs, sap-sucked, take power lines down. And loved she no peacock much as when she learned the lesser-known plight of peahens. Though Darwin viewed the cock's train rattling his opulent iridescent shimmy with vexed, avowed disgust, such brazen vulnerability, to what end? The end is known to hens, whose unfair sex selects what beauty will or not bear consequence.
Thank you, Jen.
Yeah.
So for this particular one, it's so interesting to me because it's not necessarily something that you feel like, for me, on the surface, connects to the surface that you were looking at as the omniscient fictional voice of the fictional woman, rather.
Yeah. I was thinking about this, the man in the image that is donning a costume that is traditionally worn by women and worn by women to be alluring to men, and that sort of razzle-dazzle of it, and actually,
I'm so glad you said razzle dazzle. I feel like we don't get that nearly enough on Living Writers. But sorry to interrupt.
We need more razzle dazzle.
Oh, yes, daily.
And actually, it was a student in another 125 class who made me aware of the peahens that she was, and she was writing about how the peahen looks at the peacock strutting their very long tail and inspects them. And the peacock's tail, the whole thing makes them more susceptible to predators, but they do this, this dance
display.
They fan their fans and hold their tails at an angle to the sun to best show off the iridescence of the tails and the eyes. It's sort of fascinating. And this was something that Darwin was disgusted by. And so there's just so much about, you know, and of course, This is a thing about how, you know, what males are supposed to, men in our society are yes or no supposed to be wearing, and what society has said masculinity is supposed to look like. And this is a man that's not showing us that, and is also, though, in a courtship dance, presenting himself for a woman. He's presenting himself for a heterosexual potential, relationship. And romantic relationship. And so, yeah, there was just a lot. And so thinking about the messiness of, and the vulnerability of that, and the way that flowers are so, these gorgeous, you know, creations of progeny, and they make a mess all over the driveway, and they, you know, and, yeah, so I think that's, all these things were kind of spinning in my head.
Jen, while you were explaining this, you also mentioned that the idea from the peahen that came into your world through a student.
Yeah.
And I noticed in the acknowledgments when you're thanking everyone, you thank, you know,
tons of, yeah,
your students, as, and then you also say teachers, as if, like, I think that that moment, I felt like you were making it a duality of, like, students are also our teachers.
Absolutely.
As we, yes.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. And I better be a student or I'm not going to be a very good teacher. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how you structured the book.
Sure.
Do you want to guide us through of the decisions? Because
So the first thing that was happening is I was writing these sonnets that responded to the images. And then over time, I'd do more. And then I think I'd hit a wall and I'd put it aside and then I'd come back to it. And so that went on for about 7 years. And COVID happened and I was like, oh, these are irrelevant. And then I came back to them. And at some point I realized that I could see how they were taking shape, but there was something about that voyeur aspect, and the men and the images aren't showing themselves. And there's definitely issue thinking about power with an anonymity and, like, the history of violence of, like, people wearing masks or hoods or other kinds of things in order to enact violence with anonymity. And,
even down to ICE now,
absolutely,
like, without having name badges and, yes.
Absolutely. And so I realized that I needed to make my subject position clearer, and that I could do that with these sort of wild, talky endnotes. And I also realized that the poems were riddled with pop culture references. And some of them, when I started to look deeper into what they were things that, like, popped into my subconscious. And then they appeared in the poem. But then when I returned to them to see what I was actually referencing a little bit more fully, I was kind of like, oh, wow, this is so wildly there. Or there's stuff here that I didn't even know about that I was touching. But when I researched and learned
more. Yes, you were finding.
I was finding.
The coincidences that maybe weren't, like, they were in your subconscious for a reason.
Yeah. And so I just kept going down these rabbit holes. So then I realized that at some point the endnotes were, like, one of my friends who's a poet says, you think that the poems are the sonnets, but actually that's just scaffolding for the real poem, which is the endnotes. And I don't know if that's true or not, but definitely the endnotes aren't endnotes. It's its own sort of, there's a persona that comes up in the first maybe or second page. I make reference to Annie Lennox, and I have this memory of being a girl, like, 8 years old, wearing a Walkman on a swing set, hearing Annie Lennox singing and the Eurythmics singing Sweet Dreams Are Made of These. And I realized, like, oh, that's my persona, Walkman girl. And I was telling you earlier, I had a sort of revelation about that.
That was yesterday.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Walkman girl appeared.
Well, she's the image of it came to you as you were making the draft, right?
Yeah.
And then what was the revelation yesterday?
Yesterday I was thinking about that persona, and it occurred to me, because then I started to research about, like, so Walkmans, Walkmans are like proto app culture. They changed the world. Sony develops this product. It's already sort of in existence, this way of, like, walking around and, like, listening to things, but it was used for more scientific reasons. And they mass marketed it for everyday, and it changed the culture. It means that it, like, caused the huge spike in 80s gym culture. And so lots of other things. But, you know, it meant that you could have your own music that you carried around and listened to privately, which is, of course, like, we're completely attached to app culture now. But Walkman, the thing about the name Walkman girl, occurred to me that, like, man is part, Walkman is the sort of the baptismal name of this technology that became the name of the technology, not just, you know, like Kleenex. And so you have Walkman girl, you have the girl that has like been born into this like fusion of man and technology. And
well, and man would be holding more of like the power.
Of course. Yeah. And walking. And so it's also this for all anyone in Gen X. So this is very much written from a Gen X perspective. Gen X is the generation of latchkey kids and families, huge amount of families splitting. And so man walking away, you know, there's that a little bit too, I think. That's sort of interesting in thinking about coupling. It's maybe worth saying that my husband and I, that have been married for 25 years, both of us actually do come from families where both of our parents did stay together, but that was not the usual. That was kind of unlikely, and you know, that we were fortunate in that way. And so,
let's take a short break today on Living Writers. Jennifer Sperry Stein-North is here. Her book on the table with us, Boys Behind Glass. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
Excuse me, but can I be you for a while? My dog won't bite if you sit real still. I got the Antichrist in the kitchen yelling at me again. Yeah, I can hear. Been saved again by the garbage truck. I got something to say, you know, but nothing comes. Yes, I know what you think of me. You never shut up. Yeah, I can hear that. But what if I'm a mermaid in these jeans of his with her name still on it? Hey, but I don't care. Cause sometimes I said, sometimes I hear my voice and it's been he. Really deep thoughts. What's so amazing about really deep thoughts? Boy, you best pray that I bleed real soon. How's that thought for you? My screen got lost in a paper cup. I think there's a heaven where some screams have gone. I got 25 bucks and a cracker. Do you think it's enough to get us there? Cause what if I'm jeans of his with her name still on it, hey, but I don't care, cause sometimes I said, sometimes I hear my voice, and it's been he.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're just in time. Today on Living Writers, Jennifer Sperry Stein-North is here in the studio, Boys Behind Glass, the book on the table with us. And we're so lucky to also have Jen's English 125 class here. So you're actually, from your short bio, you know, you're educator, poet, yeah. All of these things. You've got this mix happening even in this moment.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, creating something new here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I have, I'm also a mother of sons. So it was, and they're adult, they're 23 and 25, soon to be 24, 26. And it was fun to talk about this with them as young people, you know, of their generation and how they're thinking about some of these things while I was working on this.
Did any of their takes come to bear or so? Or
yeah. There are definitely places that they pop up and pieces of information that they gave me. But one thing that I can recall is my eldest son, Simon, almost closes the book down with some information he was giving me about the way that beavers terraformed North America. And
yes,
that's like one of the sort of images that is the last to sort of show up in the speculum, which is the speculum is the last half of the book that, or the second half of the book, which is the end notes, quote unquote.
Which is the, and it's also the persona of the Walkman girl present in there as a, so the voice shifts from the omniscient fictional woman voice from the first part.
Yeah. The end notes do read, I mean, it's, there's a lot of facts. There's a lot of data information, but it's also sort of in a witty voice, in a sort of, there's a little bit of sardonic voice. And then there, and Walkman Girl is appearing with, the information about Walkman Girl is revealed through the third person. So it's not a first person account, but
it's always, it feels so playful. Like was, so as you were like putting together the book too, you have, you know, like the table of contents that you'd expect. And then the map of the, or the list of the portraits. But then there's already things that seem to be pushing back against expectations, like the next page is okay, okay. And then a floating frame, and it's sort of defining the different parts, the lookbook, the little songs, the speculum, and you turn the page and it says table of impatience.
Yeah.
So there's just these, and this, that's not even the funniest part on that page, because you look at it and, which I loved though, right away, I was like, this is a poet at play is what I felt like. And having like, but serious play, like there's serious things being thought of in this, like what you've also been talking, you know, today about. It's not like a book of jokes.
Right. There are jokes, but yeah.
But it's funny. And that like, just when you think there might not be another thing to comment on, then there is. Like there's one asterisk or two asterisks. It's like there's different, like these layers of like where the voice is coming through.
Yeah.
Since we've been talking about it, it is maybe more abstract to hear about.
Right, sure.
Could you take us through with a particular piece?
Yeah. And actually, if there's time, we could look at some of that. But I'll read. The first poem, there is a prelude poem that is not attached to a portrait, a watercolor portrait, but I'll read the first sonnet that is attached to an image. And that is, the poem is called Torso of a Man in Plaid. And guess what? It's a picture of the torso of a man in plaid. He is, it's cut just below, you get a little bit of the chin, and he is sort of before, he's like leaning on maybe a telephone pole or a tree. This is one where the poem actually gives you a little bit of a description. I don't often do that, but so I won't say more about the image. Torso of a man in plaid. The Queen of Hearts says off with their heads, but guillotined suitors make this lass lonely, or worse, aware. Has she shut herself in a room of one-way mirrors? Her mind observes her face. Her scowl troubles her mind. She clocks herself outside herself, even with closed eyes. But can they? Why not face what she would face should they meet face to face, should either ever propose? No one escapes, even in plaid, sleeves rolled, buttons done up, save for the throat, the foe in the looking glass. Though he staged his play before an obscure hedge, she knows of what he is afraid, plain as the nonchalance of his bearded frame. If there were a face to face, would it turn away? So that's the opening.
Thanks, John.
Yeah. Should I read a little from the endnotes?
I think so, because also then there's a you get to the page where the painter, Jenny Walton, then also says something about
That's in a separate section. Did you want me to find that?
No, it's okay. We'll go to your endnotes,
okay.
But it's in like, that's why it seems like the layers are never ending in the project.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then there's an index, which... I've never indexed anything before, but that was really fun too, to be like, okay, this, but I'll read a little bit of the end notes. And so I'm not going to read top to bottom. I'm going to read a little bit of the top end notes, and then there are footnotes to the end notes, and then there's some asterisks to the footnotes, which I'd call toenails, but right. I'll just read it a little bit. Let's see. So it's riffing off the line, the Queen of Hearts says, off with their heads. Carol's consummate bully, that's Lewis Carroll, the author of Alice in Wonderland. Carol's consummate bully is so distracted, or her subjects so heedless. Though the monarch dispatches 4 death sentences, we witness 0 guillotined stumps. Alas, you, gentle reader, must begrudge or forgive us these many headless chicken runs. And then there's a footnote to headless chicken runs. So I'm thinking about all these beheaded men. The case of Mike the Headless Chicken, born April 20th, 1945, decapitated September 10th, 1945, but died March 17th, 1947, a longer run headless than not, put a name and a facelessness to the gallinaceous propensity to gallivant haphazardly post-acts. Nevertheless, the analogous phrase goes back 6 centuries, suggesting the headless chicken dance, a waddle made possible by bird brains that extend well down the neck, and a mysterious organ with mechanosensing capabilities, call it a second brain, which, like a human's, is located in the pelvis, is surprisingly, alarmingly common. Less common, of course, is sustained free-roaming beheadedness. Beyond his not-quite-dumb luck, the bird could almost cluck, Mike's deadhead days came at the pains of his assailant and would-be gobbler, Floyd Olson, with watery milk and an eyedropper. The Colorado farmer kept the Wendicott cock alive, transforming Mike into a touring sideshow star that fetched a quarter a gander. At his best, the cock grossed $4,500 a month, $70,000 a month today, no chicken scratch. One wonders if the miraculous bird was the namesake of Magic Mike, those cocks strutting their stuff, or if his acclaim, a feature in both Life and Time magazine, led to Michael's nearly 50-year reign as the most popular boy's name, a game Mike loses when we consider not longevity, but frequency to ahem, Jen, Jennifer, Jenny.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, Jen. So walk us through how you were redrafting that. Like, how did that become part of, like, what you knew this project was?
Oh, let me see. I mean, I think I kept stumbling into, I mean, thinking about the Queen of Hearts, like, she shows up in the poem, and then in talking about her, I'm thinking about headless chickens and, like, also chicken as a metaphor, like when you're a chicken, you're a coward. And the way that, you know, there's some amount of me feeling like the lack of being willing to put yourself, like, represent yourself, and sort of the anonymity is a sort of cowardice. So, and also then stumbling into, by just saying the word headless chicken, all of a sudden I'm researching the headless chicken dance, like the phenomenon, what is that about? And then I'm researching that, and I find out about this Mike. Yeah. And
what a, like, breadwinner.
Yeah. And so then I'm like, well, that's just, like, amazing. And right. And so then to have this headless chicken that is, like, a spectacle, because so much is about the spectacle, or about being a spectator versus being a performer. Oh,
bringing back the gaze.
The
as
gaze,
well, and the
yeah.
perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I really was thinking about the gaze a whole lot when I first encountered this project. And but also commodity. Like, also the the capitalizing on one's performance or some power person that is doing that.
Was it so? Was because this
like the man, the farmer, you know?
Yes. This poem, choosing this poem to be the lead poem after the framing, the first sonnet, was that so that because you wrote that, it feels like it gives us a way in to the torsos to come, and it's a lens to kind of see those through as well.
Yeah, definitely. And this idea of like the face, understanding, I feel like in the poem, there is a sort of sympathy. She's frustrated that she can't see, but also she gets it. Like it's scary to put oneself out there and to not know if when you put yourself out there, the person that you're reaching out to will turn away or will say like, I don't want to see you, you know?
Was it curious to you too, that this one was because, Jenny Walton's project was titled Match Enemy, as you said. And this was her biggest match. This one, the 97.5, I think.
Oh, right. Yes. That is interesting.
But, oh, so just a coincidence.
Yeah, that's coincidental. Okay. Yeah.
Because you chose it for different reasons.
Yeah, I chose it for the entry, what you said, that sort of entry point into the project. It felt like, it raises those ideas of anonymity, but also with a.
Okay. We're going to take a short break. Okay. Boys Behind Glass. Jen's book on the table with us, Jennifer Sperry Stein North. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
Fellas, I'm ready to get up and do my thing. Go ahead. I want to get into it, man, you know.
Go ahead.
Like a sex machine, man.
Yeah.
Moving, doing it, you know.
Yeah.
Can I count it off?
Go ahead.
One, two, three, four. Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
On the scene,
get on up
like a sex machine.
Get on up,
get up,
get on up,
get up,
get on up.
Stay on the scene,
get on up
like a sex machine.
Get on up,
get up,
get on up.
Stay on the scene,
get on up
like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Wait a minute, shake your arm, then use your palm. Stay on the scene like a sex machine. You got to have the feeling, sure as your bone. Get it together, right on, right on. Get up,
get on up.
Get up,
get on up.
Get up,
get on up.
If you're just tuning in, you're just in time, because today on Living Writers, Jen Stein North is here with her latest book, out with TRP, the University Press of SHSU, Boys Behind Glass. If you're in the Chicago area, you can see Jen Stein North this coming weekend. Jen, your website is your name, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep. JenSperrySteinworth.com or Jennifer Sperry Steinworth.
And you've got like an events tab so people can find you. And
yes,
if they're in the Chicago area or taking a road trip. And then closer to home, Jen will be here at Literati and in Traverse City, coming up as things warm up a little bit more.
Yeah.
Okay. So I wanted to say also that I love today maybe it was last night, because we've been emailing back and forth, where you said, I'm looking forward to talking about this strange beast with you. What is your, now that you see Boys Behind Glass in the world, we've gotten to hear a little bit about sort of the making of it and the sense of the fun and the playfulness and the structure of it as well. What's it like? I don't know, seeing the book now, what is it? It was Strange Beast or?
Yeah. I mean, it's such a maximalist undertaking, and I didn't think that that was me, because I often write, I often think in terms of fragment and gesture. And I still think that is true.
Is that because of your dancing
roots?
Because you used to be a dancer for years.
Yeah. But her read, my second book, is definitely has a, even though it's erasure, so it's taking away, and it definitely is using the fragment, but it is erasing. It erases a 266-page text entirely and uses every page. And so this is sort of opposite in terms of the structure, where with erasure, I'm taking away to create a new text. With this one, everything is additive. I'm looking at an image. I'm writing a sonnet. I'm taking whatever populates the lines of the sonnet. I'm using that as like a diving board, or to launch. I keep thinking in terms of rabbit holes. But so that goes and goes and goes.
Like Alice in Wonderland.
Alice in Wonderland. And also the internet, because there's so much of it that's like a digital tech component, and the mirrors and the windows. There's like one huge component that shows up a lot in the endnotes. The speculum is the like history of the mirror, the history of, and the way that that history informed consciousness and shifted. And then, of course, we have selfies. And, you know, actually, my class, we began with a project, the first project, they were. We went to the Argus Museum.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And, yeah. In the West Side.
Yeah. But so for many, you know, they know cameras as attached to their phones, not as separate entities, as like the technology that, you know, it was just a camera. And there's something very, so there's, this book is very much, that's another way in which it's sort of thinking in terms of the Gen X that comes in terms of being a bridge between the analog and the digital, where we're very much conscious of the analog, and that was in our coming of age, but very quickly segueing into the digital realm.
But Boys Behind Glass then actually captures the analog and freezes it in the moment and shows like what the like your mind was doing as the maker with this material.
Absolutely. And actually, I guess I should also say that what became apparent to me, and where this book totally ran into a different, became a different animal entirely, is that I started doing the endnotes, and I had ideas for it and I was making notes, but I didn't really set down to do it until the beginning of October 2024. And at that time, I was thinking very much about and stumbling into the fact that incel culture, for example, was born, it was named at the turn of the century, and it was coming into being in the digital realm, and in these like underground chat rooms. And so I started to see the ways in which discontent that was taking place in those underground spaces was now in 2024 marching openly in the streets, and either masked or unmasked, and carrying weapons. And that's maybe too easy of a bridge to build, but that's another way I think that the generational perspective of coming up in the 90s in an era of resistance to what was happening in the 80s, the grunge and the Rage Against the Machine and, you know, Public Enemy. And so this sort of thing that was like had promise that then, you know, looking at where we are right now, thinking about like, how did we get here? And so this is very much like thinking about the old technologies, going back to like mirrors and like cowboys, this idea of like, How did the cowboy become this cultural icon when, in fact, when cowboys were in their heyday, they were the scourge? Nobody wanted to be a cowboy. I mean, maybe people, I don't know. I don't know who wanted to be a cowboy and who didn't, but they definitely weren't people that were heroes. And so, you know, that all of these things are sort of getting deconstructed as a way of thinking about where are we now and how do we get here?
Yeah. It was so interesting too to hear you say that your other book, like The Erasure, yeah, and then this one is additive. It makes me wonder what are you working on right now for poems? Because I know you have your continuing work with the biography of C.D. Wright.
Yeah.
Which maybe we should say a few words about too. But maybe the first question first. What are you like? What's it look like now with your poems?
I haven't written. I've been doing more lyric writing in prose form for like essays and things. I have a Substack called O is for Octopus, and so that's been fun. I'm also thinking about being a person with chronic illness and disability in the world and life as creative process. So applying thinking about the sort of discoveries and problem solving that happen in the creative process of art making and how those overlap with living in the world with disability and just living as a human in general, trying to make ethical, conscientious, healthy choices for myself and, you know, do good in the world. So,
but it's becoming more like the lyrical essays.
Lyric essays, okay. Yeah. So that's something I've been doing. There's another project with playing with Little Red Riding Hood and thinking about the grandmother figure. So that's something else that's the project that I'll definitely be working on, but it's a little bit farther from my consciousness right now.
Yeah. But working in that, again, that like world, like the fairy tales.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And thinking also, yeah, about environment and thinking about age and the things that we push off from the periphery. It's interesting to me. And I think all of these things connect. The idea that I've been working with is this idea that the grandmother was once Little Red. And so the grandmother has the knowledge of the predator relationship and, you know, maybe live to tell the tale. And so, but is in the woods in sort of, maybe not in exile, but not. So I don't know. There's some interesting ideas there that I'm.
Maybe the grandmother's the hero.
Yeah.
Not the woodsman.
Yeah. Indeed.
Maybe, right?
Indeed. Yes.
Jen, thanks so much for being here today.
And thanks for having me.
It was lovely to talk with you.
Likewise.
About Boys Behind Glass. Out now with TRP, the University Press of SHSU. You can catch Jen in Chicago this weekend, and she'll be coming to our neck of the woods when it warms up more in spring. Everybody, fundraiser is coming down the track, so get ready. Get ready to rock and roll. And we're going to have poet Kelly Hoffer next week on the special fundraiser show. So
awesome.
Please call in and give us your 2 cents and your ideas and maybe whatever else you'd like to give us. Thanks so much, Jen. Boys Behind Glass. I'm T. Hetzel. Thanks, everyone out there, for listening. Thanks to the Rev for engineering today. Thanks to JAV for pulling the songs. Oh, and for Jen for picking the songs for today. And thanks, Mom, for listening. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
Okay.